friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams, and welcome to another episode of the Diversify Impact Podcast. This podcast explores how investing in diversity can lead to a high return of investment in pathology and laboratory medicine by learning from the knowledge and experiences of diverse voices within our field. My next guest is Dr. Sarah Jang. Dr. Jang is Associate Professor of Pathology at Duke University, Chief of the Head and Neck Service, and Director of the Duke Pathology Communications Group. Her areas of research and expertise are cytopathology and surgical pathology of the head and neck and endocrine systems, with particular interest in thyroid nodules, ultrasound-guided FNA, and novel applications of social media for medical professionals. She is an active member in committees and leadership to the National Pathology and Medical Organization, including the USCAP, ATA, CAP, ASCP, and ASC. It has been honored with local and national awards, including the ASCP 2017 40 Under 40 Top 5, Duke Pathology Piezo Faculty Research Mentor Award, the Pathologist Magazine Power List, and a 2019 CAP Resident Advocate Award. Without further ado, here is Dr. Sarah Jang.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. I'm here with my next guest, Dr. Jang. Dr. Jang, can you tell us who you are, where you are from, and your pronouns?
Hi, I'm so delighted to be here. I'm Xiaoying Sarah Jiang, and I am from, a lot of places. So I was born in Shanghai, and I moved to Chicago when I was a kid, and I grew up kind of all over the place, California, South Carolina, New York, Durham, North Carolina, and my pronouns are she, her, hers. And I am here in Durham, North Carolina. I'm an associate professor of pathology at Duke, and I'm also the chief of the head and neck service, the director of the Duke Pathology Communications Group, and I think those are all my official titles, but I do a bunch of other stuff for various organizations, and I am part of the PathPod podcast team, and I'm just so delighted to be here with you, Michael, having this conversation.
Yay! I'm so happy for you to be here as well, too. It's been such a fun adventure for me, having each guest on, and I'm excited to cheer on today, too. I promise we're going to have fun.
I feel like with the two of us, there's no way we could not have fun, and hopefully we'll share some, you know, insights as well. But yeah, I'm excited about this conversation.
All right. Well, so how did you get involved in pathology and cytopathology?
So yeah, I was not one of those people who wanted to be a pathologist coming to medical school. In fact, Duke has a very wonderful pathologist assistance program. One of my good friends was in that program, and we'd sit together. You know, we had our first year lectures together. We'd sit together, and she'd be like, "Wouldn't that be so funny if you went into pathology, and then I was your pathology assistant? We could run a practice together." And I was like, "Haha, but I'm not going to be a pathologist. I'm going to be a real doctor, right? Because I came in with all these misconceptions about pathology." And the way I really got into pathology is at Duke, the third year is a research year. And I thought I wanted to do neuro-oncology or neurology or maybe neurosurgery. And so I did my research at the Brain Tumor Center. And during that year, I got to work with a neuropathologist at Duke and just really got to sit with them, look at the histology. And what struck me was not only was the work interesting, but the people were happy, they were collegial, they were an integral part of the treatment team. And really over that year, I fell in love with pathology. I'd always enjoyed my pathology courses. We have really awesome pathology teaching at Duke that now I get to be on the teaching part of. And I just fell in love with it. And so applied to pathology, accepted me, and I've absolutely loved it. I've loved it ever since. And in terms of the cytopathology piece, you know, I am kind of an extrovert. I love to talk. I love people. I love interacting mm-hmm. with patients. And that patient care piece was a piece that I always really enjoyed. So, you know, definitely not the stereotype of like, you know, going into pathology because I didn't like people. And so in cytopathology, it's one of the areas in pathology, along with, you know, transfusion medicine, where you get to have direct patient procedures. The other piece, I love working with my hands. I love procedures. And so to be able to have all mm-hmm. of that wrapped into, I also love instant gratification. So if you're a cytopathologist, you know, you get to see the patient in my FNA clinic, meet them, get them comfortable with you, explain the procedure, perform the procedure, and then you get to have almost an immediate answer in a lot of cases. And so for me, it's just this wonderful combination that harnesses into the things that I enjoy, my skills, and I get to still see patients, have that face-to-face contact in that limited setting, get to do my procedures, and I get to, you know, get diagnoses with like a little 23 gauge or 25 gauge needle, and it is just amazing. So love cytopathology, and I think that the cytopathology community within mm-hmm. pathology is just really fun. I love going to the ASC meetings. I always feel like, you know, the cytopathologists have the greatest parties. Sorry for the rest of y'all, you know, out there not in non-cytopathology world, but yeah, so this kind of a long answer, but truly I love it. I love it. I love what I get to do. I love the balance of, you know, diagnostics, patient care. I love being in academics, and it's definitely busy, but every day is different. I come in, I get to see different things, and no regrets.
Okay, love it. And can you, just for new listeners who are non-pathologists, can you describe what FNA stands for?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So fine needle aspiration biopsy. So it's very simple procedure, but so powerful. You take a very small needle, 23, 25, and sample lesions. It takes a few seconds. You can do it in your office. Mm-hmm. It's very minimally invasive. And it's, like I said, it's this incredibly powerful technique where you can get a diagnosis, or at least usually a pretty good sense of what you're dealing with in just a few minutes. And yeah, that's what I do mm-hmm. in our clinic. And at Duke, we have an ultrasound too, so we can do ultrasound guided biopsies. It's super rewarding.
So let's just transition into the Twitterverse, because that's how I met many of my pathology friends.
yeah, that's how we met, right? So
yes. Mm-hmm. And how did you what was your journey for Twitter and social media, and what do you feel like you have gained from that journey in general?
So, yeah, Twitter actually just reminded me that I've been on Twitter for 10 years, and I had no idea it had been so long, because in some ways it feels like Twitter has always been a part of my career. I was inspired to join fairly early on. I think probably I was one of the early adopters, and like many of us, we were inspired by Jared Gardner, who Jared really kind of led the way and was so passionate about, you know, starting to use social media. And I found it to be just absolutely, like, one of the best things I've done for my career, because I think that, you know, as I've mentioned, I'm an extrovert. I love people. I'm a people person. Mm-hmm. And it's been mm-hmm. this way to kind of make these personal connections over the course of years. It's built friendships. I've met people like you and people across the world and made real friends, real collaborators that I would have mm-hmm. never met otherwise had I not been involved in social media. It's so fun. I learn things. I get to share things with other people. And especially, mm-hmm. I feel like during the pandemic, this past year and a half, that social media is how we stay social, how we stay connected. And I know we all have a million Zoom calls, but those are not the same at all, because I feel like Zoom is, you know, transactional. You're having your meetings, you're getting your work done. But on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, that's where those personal connections and relationships and stories are being built. And I think that, to me, is really the rewarding part of being in this field, is being able to be working together with like-minded people, helping to, mm-hmm. you know, basically move the field forward and educate and hopefully recruit the next generation of pathologists. So I just, mm-hmm. I love it. And certainly, had I not been on Twitter, I feel like pathology would be a more lonely and not quite as productive a place. So for any listeners who are not on social media, you need to get on it. Otherwise, you're missing out, you know? The FOMO is real.
You also started a podcast. You talked about PathPod earlier. What was your inspiration for that?
Oh my gosh. So To be honest, my inspiration was that I am a quiz show nerd. Anyone who's listened to the quiz show knows, like, I love quiz shows and trivia, and I listen to NPR. Very sadly, my favorite NPR show, Ask Me Another, has just had his final show, but I love those. And so I was like, oh my gosh, we should do one of these for pathology. And towards the beginning of the pandemic last year, you know, Dr. Kamran Mirza had this great idea to create Path Elective, which has become so successful. And as part of that, we had this idea with Drs. Michael and Christina Arnold and Dr. Mirza and myself. We kind of, you know, took that idea that I initially had of, hey, let's do a Path quiz show, and expanded upon it to say, why don't we do a whole podcast to share these stories of pathology? Because part of what we were worried about was, with the pandemic, we couldn't have in-person rotations, we couldn't have med students come with us, and that we were going to be losing out on this opportunity to share basically how awesome pathology is with the world, with potential medical students. And so that's where really it came along, is to be able to share these pathologist stories with people even while we were social distancing. And I was so fortunate to have such an incredible group of people to work with, to make it a reality, because I had never podcasted before. I didn't know the first thing about it. And over this past year, it's just been one of the most rewarding projects. You know, if you think about me as an academic, I'm supposed to be writing papers and doing research, and I still do that and I still love it. But the Path Pod has really been something that has been a passion project, and I've had so much fun being able to torture people with bad puns, and then also interview so many amazing pathologists, hear their stories. I have had so much fun with it. It's been really great.
So let's talk about another passion of yours.
I have so many. I have so many. I need to learn how to say no, right? Because I feel like I'm one of those naturally enthusiastic people, and it gets me in trouble.
Because you're like, oh, I want to do it, I want to do it. And you're just like, ooh, wait, let's see.
Yep.
But let's talk about the craft thing, though.
Yeah. So I, the listeners can't see, but I'm in my craft room right now. And one of the things that I love to do in my spare time, which I don't have very much of, is ever since, even before med school, I love crafts. So knitting, sewing, crocheting, painting, jewelry making. For a while, I was making little polymer clay charms that look like little neutrophils or sushi or things like that. So I love working with my hands. You know, I kind of talked about how I love procedures. I was always like a great med student in the ED, because anytime anyone came in with a laceration, I was like, I will go sew that person up, because I just love it. I love working with my hands. And that's something that definitely is what I do to relax. So I have discovered over the years, actually, that many pathologists have crafty inclinations. I remember talking when I went on the interview trail oh so many years ago that, you know, I put knitting and crocheting as my hobbies. I had so many pathologists talk to me about that, like, oh, what do you knit? What are you working on? And so we had so many good conversations. And it further made me feel like, when I was interviewing, that I really was in the right field, because not only was I talking to these famous high-powered pathologists, but we were talking about knitting, because they had interests outside of work. They were able to do things outside of work. They were interested in who I was as a human. And I felt like, you know, I still feel like that holds true for our field, is that we are, even if you're a high-powered pathologist somewhere, you care about your trainees as people, and you want to get to know them as people. And I love having conversations with my trainees about, like, hey, what's your favorite Indian restaurant around here? You know, what's my favorite Chinese restaurant around here, right? And so being able to kind of have those personal connections still, I feel like, makes our field just the best and stronger.
And is that sort of that's advice we can give to those who are applying to PathMatch 2022?
It's so funny. It sounds like we're in the future, right? And I guess we are. The future is now.
To just be themselves and just go out and see what programs they vibe with in general, and, you know, just put what you're really passionate about. Don't subtract that because you feel like that would make you different or an outlier, when in actuality it could probably make you stand up more and more memorable, more memorable during the interview process.
I think it's so important that that fit with a program. And I think that trying to assess that during virtual times can be a little bit more challenging. I would say that I think a lot of programs are trying to have open houses where you can talk a little bit more informally with residents. Obviously, the virtual platform is, you know, not as casual as going out to dinner with the residents beforehand. But I think just kind of getting a sense of who the people are, what their interactions are like, and being able to bring your authentic self is so important, because you want to be somewhere where your authentic self is going to be welcomed and not like, yeah, we're going to have to hide like this big piece of who you actually are as a human. And I think that from my perspective, you know, I think that certainly our program and many of the people where I see faculty in different programs, we want to have the whole person. We want people to be able to thrive, not just as a pathologist, but as a full human being, and be successful as a full human being, not just, you know, here's a slide, here's a diagnosis. You know, you're not a computer algorithm, right?
And I want to transition, because you talked about being your true self and the authenticity. When you came here as a child to the United States and you had to introduce yourself to like friends or, you know, classmates, how was the interaction in terms of like saying, did you say my name is Sarah, or did you?
Oh no! So this is it's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. So I came to the U.S. when I was 5 years old, and I did not speak any English, like zero English. And we moved to Chicago, and you know, this was like, I'm not going to say how long ago it was, but it was a while. And this was, you know, the Chicago public school system. Love it. Under-resourced then, and it was very, very different. So it was me, a little Chinese girl, didn't speak any English, and I think maybe everybody else in my class was African-American. And so it was a big, big cultural shift. And I didn't go, you know, Sarah is just something I picked. And so it was, I spent a lot of time, well, number one, learning English. So I spent a lot of time learning English. It was a big cultural shift, and I spent a lot of time telling people how to pronounce my name. So Xiaoying, it's spelled with an X. People in the U.S. freak out when they see it. They don't know what to do. And so I knew every time a substitute teacher was in the class, you know, when they stopped and looked confused, I was like, yep, that's me. That's me. And so around third grade, I was like, you know what? I am tired of spending all this time on teaching people how to say my name correctly. I'm just going to make it easier for myself and go by Sarah, because Sarah is like a very common name. It means a princess, which, you know, kind of liked. And so over the years, you know, that's why I go by Sarah, basically because I made the decision that I was tired of putting my energy into spending all that time teaching people how to say my name correctly. And I think that that's something that, you know, over the years, I've thought about that a lot, because names mean a lot, right? What you go by means a lot. And certainly in pathology, you know, we spend all day thinking about what we're going to name a tumor, and putting that name on it is so important. And for me, I made the decision to go by Sarah, and I stick by that decision because, quite honestly, maybe I'm a little bit lazy and I don't want to spend, you know, the 15 minutes every time I meet someone new of explaining to them, oh yeah, you know, this is how you say my name. Like, and I've often gotten comments like, oh, but your name is so beautiful, you should go by that. And I think that's lovely. I know my name is beautiful. Xiaoying is beautiful. It means dawn, glint of jade. It's awesome. But at the same time, I think that as individuals, we have the power and agency to choose our own names and what we go by. And the decision I've made is that, you know, honestly, it's not where I want to spend my energy meeting new people, is how teaching them how to pronounce my name. And so I like Sarah. I've gone by it for so long. And, you know, I think it's my name, Sarah Jiang, reflects who I am as a person, which is that I am Chinese, but I'm American too. And I think that's one of the things that, so my name actually does reflect who I am, because I'm, you know, I was born in China. I am an immigrant, and I, you know, do have that very strong, and my face is Chinese, right? Like, that's something that when people meet me, they see that I don't look American. At the same time, I moved here when I was five. I grew up in America, I'm very much culturally American. And so I think I do have that experience of straddling both sides. And it's been something that has had an impact on who I am, both personally as and professionally, because it has always been a little bit of being an outsider. Whether I'm here in the U.S., which is home, which is where I've grown up, I'm a U.S. citizen, you know, this is where my life is, but I'm still foreign because, well, of the way I look, right, and my name. And then, you know, back in the day when travel was a thing, I would go, you know, back home to Shanghai to visit my grandparents, and it was very clear that I was foreign there, too, because I felt like things were foreign, that I didn't understand the culture, that I behaved in ways that were Western and American and didn't fit in there. And so it's been kind of this interesting experience, even as it's certainly been, you know, I have a lot of privilege having access to both the Chinese and American parts of my being and personality. I have the privilege of, you know, speaking English without an accent, right? Because that leads to a lot of stigma and stereotype. If you don't speak English, if you speak English with an accent, people look at you differently and treat you differently. Even as I've had that privilege, I do think that it's been something I've always struggled with is, you know, like, so where is home, right? Like, people are like, you know, the racist things people say are like, you know, go back to China or, you know, all these, even like, microaggressions, like, where did you learn to speak English so well, or, you know, things like that. You know, it's been something that I've struggled with because it's always being an other, being visibly an other here in the U.S. and being culturally and interiorly an other in China. So that's been a part of what's shaped my experience, and that's why I say I think names are really important. Just one more kind of like aspect of it. My husband is white, and you know, I did not take his last name, because if I took his last name, then it would be erasing that, you know, Jang half of my personality, and I would have this totally white person name. And you know, he and I kind of joked about it. Maybe it's not very PC, but he joked that if I had taken his last name, I would have gotten more responses when I sent out my CV for job applications or residency applications, because, you know, you look at my Chinese name, which I have on my CV, Xiao Ying Jing, and it's, you know, people are like, oh, this is going to be someone who doesn't speak English or is not going to communicate as well. And all the negative stereotypes that come along with having a foreign name, you know, I got to experience those when I threw my CV out there. So, you know, I always joke that, yeah, you know, it would have been easier to just erase that part of my identity. But, you know, that's not something I want to do just to be more successful, right?
No, and it's interesting. I've heard there were studies that, like, for example, on the African-American or Black side, they'll have an applicant, like, and they'll say Jamal, and send that CV out, and then send somebody else who has, like, a really, I don't know, Christian or, I guess, white-sounding name, like, my name is Michael or Mike. And that the responses to Mike was more for interviews compared to Jamal. And so names are important because you don't want to be like, all right, I have to change my identity in order to conform and also to support myself in general. But at the same time, it's like, well, what do I do, or how do I make it work? And we eventually make it work. We eventually make it for our own, but it's just hard because we don't really see it as much. We kind of feel like we're in these silos compared to, like, feeling that there's a community out there who actually kind of goes through the same thing. So that was my two cents about it.
Yeah. And I think that, like you say, we all kind of navigate our identity in different ways, and we navigate, and what could be more tied to identity than the name you choose to present to the world? And I think that from my perspective, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but I think that what's most important is that we respect individuals' own agency to make decisions about what they want to go by. And so I think that would be my take home. And I think, and you know, it is like, you know, I think it's inappropriate to lecture people on, you know, oh no, you should do this, you should go by this, it's so beautiful, it's so that. Well, like, I know it's beautiful. Like, I, you know, like, my name is beautiful, but I have made the intentional choice as a grown adult who has gone through life in this body, in this person, to go by this name, mm-hmm. right? So,
all right. So I'll go on to the next question. What ways did you feel supported when people discuss and confronted the hashtag stop AAPI, stop hate, either on social media or in person, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so this is obviously something that's impacted me as an Asian person throughout my career, is the negative stereotypes, the microaggressions, the comments by people, again, because it's very obvious when I walk into clinic with a patient that I'm Asian, right? And I'm not from here. And often we have a team mm-hmm. of physicians who are all not from here, as it were. And so I think this past year, with the pandemic, with some of the politicization and the messaging and the racist mm-hmm. And xenophobic messaging that was very, very prevalent from our then president, mm-hmm. that definitely came into focus a lot more. I think there were certainly more incidents that I experienced, that my Asian colleagues experienced at work, where the racism was more overt. It almost felt like people felt like they had more permission to act on these racist impulses. And so it was certainly challenging. I think it was challenging not only, you know, as a physician, we were already struggling with the politicization of the virus. We were struggling with having to come into the hospital, not knowing if we were going to bring home something that was going to get our family sick, you know, with a lot of pathologists mm-hmm. struggling due to loss of volume. So on top of that, we were also dealing with, obviously, issues related to increased incidence of racism, whether it's overt or microaggressions. And so when the hashtag started trending, because finally, there was enough critical mass that it even broke onto the mainstream media. To me, the positive that came out of that hashtag campaign is that people were more aware of it. I think that in general, if you're not Asian, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're not Asian, the ideas around the Asian experience in America is, right, the model minority myth is that, you know, we're quiet, we work mm-hmm. hard, we become doctors, like I did, or, you know, we work in nail salons, or, you know, or run restaurants or whatever, but it's that you're fresh off the boat, but you don't rock the boat kind of thing. And I think that in general, you know, just like everyone, we don't want to speak up and we don't want to talk about the negative. We don't want to be seen as complaining, right? Because as an immigrant, you're trying to, you know, not necessarily rock the boat, because you want to mm-hmm. be able to be a productive part of this society. And so I, even with, you know, my own family, you know, I didn't talk a lot about all the racist incidents I experienced in medical training, just because it's like, well, what's the point? You know, it's just part of training and you suck it up mm-hmm. and deal with it. And I think having greater awareness that all these things were happening to Asians, I mean, for years, I think that is helpful to have the non-Asian community understand. And I think having the non-Asian community speak up and, you know, support that these mm-hmm. behaviors weren't unacceptable, it did feel validating to have that experience. I think it is important. It encouraged me to reflect on my own silence throughout medical training of, you know, not really talking about it to people except to my other Asian, you know, fellow Asian med students. We would kind of talk about it amongst ourselves and realize, hey, it's not just me, it's mm-hmm. it's happening to everyone. So I think that increased awareness is important. I think that it did shed a light on the fact that, you know, there's so much work that needs to be done, because I do think that mm-hmm. in society in general, if you're not part of a minority group of some kind, it's easy just to assume that because your friends who are from minority groups aren't talking to you about it, that it's not a problem. But it mm-hmm. did bring that visibility. And so I think insofar as it opened conversations that we really needed to have as a country to understand each other more, you know, from minorities of all backgrounds, it did have a value. Mm-hmm. I think certainly the media coverage of the murders in Atlanta also brought into focus a lot of still the ways that excuses get made for people who perpetrate really mm-hmm. heinous crimes. So I think mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. having that support, and a lot of people reached out to me to check on me, and I felt like that was very, very powerful. It's just to have my friends understand, hey, are you okay? And I appreciated that. One of the things that I thought was really important to talk about in the context of medical training is I think there were a lot of, certainly threads that I saw on Twitter on, you know, kind of bystander training and the way that people who are not minorities can help make these safe spaces for minorities and women to speak up mm-hmm. when they see behaviors that are unacceptable. Because I think, you know, one of the things that came up was that silence is so powerful. And that idea mm-hmm. of, you know, if you as, you know, a white man or a white woman stand there silently while one of your patients is saying something racist or sexist or inappropriate to your trainees, or, you know, that mm-hmm. that silence is actually very powerful. And being able to speak up and say that's not appropriate, you know, whatever stock speed phrase you have in your brain to respond to these incidents in a professional manner, just speaking up helps make that minority trainee or colleague feel supported. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we can all aspire to, no matter, you know, where we are in training.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It does give that trainee or whoever is in the room, say a nurse or somebody else on the healthcare team who probably interacts and hears this, you know, on the same level, and hearing an attending physician or somebody else on the healthcare team who is a white man or a white female in a position treating the patient to stand up and say, but it's not appropriate, it's not something that should you say to our trainees or who else in the room, because they have to feel safe, like to help to treat the patient in general and make sure that they're getting out the room safe as well too. Because it's not just going in and hearing that and like, okay, like they'll get over it because, you know, they're in medical training, it'll be like, you know, they get over it. Words are powerful. And those words of hate and continued aggressions and microaggressions and racism really does affect the physical and mental aspect of those who are getting affected by, who are affected by it. And it leads to less productivity. It leads to less sense of security going into the room and feeling like you can really do your best and be happy in terms of being able to treat the patient. You're like, not you, but in general, more fearful, more like, what kind of repercussions would I get if I say something or somebody else doesn't say something? And like, do I really want to go in and put myself in a danger? I think that's one of the like hidden sort of portions of being a minority in medicine, is that when we do confront these conversations, we do have these encounters where it could be like a microaggression. Like, for example, medical school, I went into a room with a white coat. Somebody said, oh, are you the janitor? I'm like, all right. You know, compared to somebody who's very verbally aggressive to say, I don't want you in my room because of so-and-so ethnicity or gender, like you leave, like a part of you has been attacked, and it's a continued ongoing attack in a way, but an attack. But in general, like you don't feel as productive. You feel like a portion of you has like been attacked, something that you've been so prideful about yourself, but you know that you have to protect as well. And this continued protection of trying to stay safe and do the best you can in a healthcare system that is ever evolving, but at times really slow to at certain portions, that you don't leave the room the same person you entered the room as, if that makes sense.
Right. And I was saying this really ties into what we were talking about people being able to mm-hmm. bring their whole selves to work and being able to be successful, mm-hmm. not just as a physician, but as a person. And I think that, you know, race, gender, ethnicity, identity, you know, all of that, that's who we mm-hmm. are. And if though, you know, the large pieces of who you are somehow deemed to be unacceptable in the context of practicing medicine. And you see patients or staff mm-hmm. saying things that are racist, sexist, homophobic, etc. And the people in positions of power just are silent. Mm-hmm. Then that is tacit acceptance that those types of behaviors are okay, and that those types of behaviors are something that are acceptable as part of being in the practice of medicine. And they're not. They're not. And mm-hmm. I think it can be so mm-hmm. powerful to just simply say that's not acceptable. And, you know, I wish that at any point in my medical training, when a patient was saying something like mm-hmm. that to me, that anybody at all in the room would have stepped up and said, you know, Mr. So-and-so mm-hmm. or Miss So-and-so, that's really not acceptable. And that never happened. It never happened. And it sounds surprising, right? But I think in the moment, people, you know, they may, after you leave the room, maybe, like, usually what happens is no one talks about it at all. We just pretend like it didn't happen. You know, maybe mm-hmm. if you have a particularly, mm-hmm. you know, empathetic resident, say, oh, you know, that patient's a real jerk or something like that. But that behavior doesn't get addressed head on, right? And I think, you know, like I said, with this past mm-hmm. year, like, people, I think, had definitely felt some permission to behave in even more egregious ways than previously. And I think that mm-hmm. if you're going to support your trainees, you know, it's not a big ask to ask you to say that behavior is inappropriate when it is inappropriate. It's not, you know, you can be polite about it. You can be professional about it. And I would recommend, you know, get your mental speed phrase, just like we have speed phrases for diagnosing GI biopsies. I literally have a mental speed phrase mm-hmm. of my knee-jerk response when someone says something inappropriate to me. You know, you just spit it out, because in the moment you may not have right. be able to find the words. But just like you have a speed phrase for GI biopsies, have a speed phrase for inappropriate behavior, because right. in the moment, if you don't know what to say, you're going to say nothing. And then again, there's that silence being the tacit acceptance.
Yeah. And in a reverse or flip side, also with, so patients of color, where there could be a team going into a room for a patient of color who is scared or is just trying to figure out what's going on, and either implicit bias or even other things that may impede their health care for them to get treated, because there could be times where, you know, a patient may not hear it. But when the healthcare team goes out and then makes a remark, even if it's a attending or a resident, like, somebody should step up and say, hey, yeah, that's not appropriate. You don't know what they're going through, or, you know, you don't know their story. But in a more, I guess, professional way, because I don't know how to say things in a professional way, I just kind of say it. When it became a statement that racism is social determinant of health, and it became a statement, and it was one of those things where it was like, well, yeah, like, you know, I feel like it's been like the undercurrent of the two Americas that people talk about how, you know, one person may not ever experience this stuff at all, or may not even know it existed, and others where I'm just like, well, yeah, we do know racism has and has always been a social determinant of health in many aspects. There was that thing in or I guess that upcurrent also in medicine, where it was like, stop getting political in medicine, or, you know, social attributes, like, you know, we just stick with medicine. It's like, you cannot extract the social from medicine in general. Like, if we're going to deal with the whole person, if we're going to treat them, we need to know what's happening with their, you know, social aspects too. And also, I want to do a shout out. I was in a for my research. I want to shout out to all the social workers, the nurses, everybody else, and you know, behind the scenes that helps to discharge the patients and helps get them where they need to go, because they were a really valuable force in the healthcare team. Even though I hope that they get talked about more, because they were dealing with where the patients go, how their appointments are, and stuff like that. So me rambling.
I think it's important to bring it up because, you know, we don't practice in a vacuum, right? We don't practice in a vacuum.
Right.
And the fact that I think, you know, some people are like, oh, well, just stick to the medicine. You know, that's your privilege. You know, those of us who even are in medicine, who are physicians of color or women, you know, we don't get to ignore that part of the world. That's, you know, it's here whether you like it or not, and you can stick your head in the sand. But if you're one of the ones sticking your head in the sand, it just means that you haven't had to deal with any of this yourself. But guess what? Like, your colleagues do, your patients do. You're willfully ignoring this whole other part of the world, and you're not going to be a better physician for it.
I did want to have a little slide transition. I love saying the word transition, by the way, y'all. What was your favorite city to live in when you were moving around when you were younger?
Oh my gosh. Throughout? I love traveling. I love going different places. I'm actually a big city girl at heart, right? Shanghai, big city. Mm-hmm. I have to give a shout out to New York City. So I lived there for a little while. That's where I met my husband, fell in love. And I love being back, you know, back in the day when travel was a thing, we would try to, you know, make it back and visit. And I love the energy. I love the food, oh my gosh, so much good food from all over the world. I love the shows. I love it. It's expensive and the apartments were small. We lived in a very small apartment and, you know, but I love that city. And I have to say, Shanghai is amazing. It's this amazing city, you know, back in the day when I could go back. Every time I went back, the skyline was like totally different. I mean, it is just, it is mind boggling. And again, the food, you know, for me, I think everyone probably knows, like, food is like my big thing. I love to eat. I live to eat. And and my whole pathology gig is just to support my eating habits, honestly, eating and crafting. But I love Shanghai. And I would say, you know, when travel becomes a thing again, for all the listeners out there, if you can, go visit Shanghai. It will blow your mind. The dumplings, so good. So good. One day.
Another question. Why do you think there is a lack of BIPOC pathologists and lab medicine professionals in our field currently? And how are ways we can diversify in pathology?
So I think that there are two ways that we can help increase the visibility and power of our really diverse community. Number one, we have to work within established modes of academics, so kind of change things from inside out. But then we also have ways to work outside of those established modes. So we've talked a little bit about social media. I think social media has been absolutely wonderful because it's really flattened the hierarchy outside of traditional academics. It's enhanced traditional academics, and it's really allowed a way for the diversity of our field to share their voices, to share their stories, to have their experience, have that platform, and have it be really visible to the future generation as well as to our current generation to create that community. And then within those established modes of academics, right, working within the ivory tower, if you will, I think that really here is where allies can play such a critical and important role, because I think so often the people of color and minority groups, we're the ones who end up having to do all that heavy lifting, right? We're the ones who have to do the work of educating others, advocating for ourselves. And gosh, it would be so wonderful. We already have some wonderful allies. And I think that if you are one of the non-traditionally minority groups in medicine, you have this power and you can use your privilege to help others. So just to give you a little example, I tweeted recently about Mantles, where it's an all male panel, and a really easy way for people who are maybe not in a traditionally minority group is if you were invited to a panel and you see there's no women, there's no people of color in there, speak up and just bring some light to the problem. Usually it's not that the organizers are doing it intentionally, but I think that like lack of understanding that it's problematic that in 2021 you have a panel of 8 people that's all white dudes, like probably there's no field in the world where you don't have any women experts or any people of color who are experts, right? And I think that's one of those ways that we really do need allies in those spaces to speak up to help others. And it's not just a matter of making it look good, but I think that having that visibility of people who come from different backgrounds, who are different colors, who are different, have different ways of presenting to the world, that helps increase the diversity of our pipeline. It helps us all be able to bring our best and most authentic selves to work, helps model to our trainees, and it makes the field stronger, right? So just like, you know, back when we traveled, when you go to another country, and if you have someone there who's in the know, who has that expertise and is from that area, they can give you a better sense of what's going on in that city. Having a diversity of voices within medicine makes us stronger because we understand the world that we work in, the world that our patients are going through, better than if we had only non-minority voices. So I think there's opportunities for people at all levels, whether you're a trainee, whether you're in practice, to be an ally to help lift others up.
And what are ways listeners can follow you on social media to see how your career flourishes throughout the years?
Oh yeah, so of course I'm on Twitter. It's at @SARA_JIANG. And then on everything else, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, I'm at Sarah Jang, MD.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sarah Jang. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the Diversify and Path podcast.
Oh, my gosh. It's been so much fun. I've really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for the invitation.
Hi again, friends. Well, this is it for today's episode. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to the Diversify and Path podcast. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and hope to see you soon.